Well, after Harry's magisterial treatment of Islam this morning with its global dimensions, we turn to more domestic matters, perhaps of lesser weight, and that's maybe no bad thing after such an excellent lunch, because where you are just now, I would have found myself a comfortable seat at the back and hoped that over the next hour or so my mind wouldn't be taxed too much. In this talk, I want to raise some of the questions which we find ourselves asking as we counsel those who come to us to be married and as we conduct weddings in our churches. I don't have the answers to all the questions I shall raise. I shall share with you what I myself do in certain situations, though I would have to confess that I then agonize over whether the policies I've adopted are in the best interests of the people concerned and of the church. I shall on occasion speak as the devil's advocate in an attempt to help us see that the answer to the many pastoral problems we encounter as we counsel people are not so straightforward as we might perhaps imagine. And for that reason, some of the things I shall say may appear to condone what most of us would regard as immoral behavior. They may even seem to undermine the institution of marriage, but of course I have no wish to argue with that which Scripture and Christian tradition prohibits, far less to question the very clear order for men and women which the Bible sets forth. However, if Christian marriage is to hold its own against other patterns of behavior between the sexes, then we must engage the opposing views at those points where truth or principle are at stake, and not where our prejudices might lead us. Because as we all know, the Christian cause often loses credibility because we object to something which is wrong for wrong or inadequate reasons. Now, the problems I bring to you for discussion, and I hope we shall have time for plenty of discussion, the problems I bring to you have more to do with the making of marriage than the breakup of marriage. So we won't be touching on divorce and remarriage of divorced persons. We've dealt with that in past years. Rather, we'll be thinking of those who come to us to be married in church and of the marriage ceremony in particular. And I would like to discuss what our approach should be to those who are already living together when they ask if we will marry them. But first, and quite briefly, two matters which I think disturb us all from time to time. First of all, the marriage in church of those who have no connection whatsoever with the church, but who for various reasons wish to be married in church. Now, as we know, couples may want to be married in church for a whole variety of reasons. The reasons may be sentimental. A church wedding, they say, is so much nicer than a registry office wedding. Or the reason may be religious. The couple may feel that the marriage vow should be taken before God and the marriage solemnized in church by a minister or a priest. Then there are aesthetic reasons for preferring a church wedding to a registry office wedding. A church building often provides so much better a setting. And so the church is seen as a kind of film set against which the ceremony is enacted. It isn't so much a matter of being married in church as being married in this or that particular church, because the features of the building make it a fine backcloth for a wedding. And so the reasons why couples want to be married in church are varied and many. Now, clearly, people who want to be married in church for any of these reasons are really using the church. And the question is, should we allow them to do so? A minister friend asks three questions of couples who come to him to get married. First, why do you want to get married? And the answers to that are often interesting. Then second, why do you want to get married in church? And thirdly, why do you want to get married in this church? I think if we ask folk these three simple questions, They will help to uncover people's motives and may even open the way to a conversation which gets beyond the niceties. On balance, I am prepared to allow people to use the church, because on occasions, though I confess that they are rare, the contact with the couple and their families proves to be spiritually fruitful. Weddings, along with funerals, provide us with the opportunity to minister the grace and truth of the gospel to people who otherwise never darken the door of the church. So I think in this area we should be open-minded and tolerant. That said, the feel and the tone of such weddings is often at odds with Christian values. They are, as someone put it, a great excess. The lavish expense, the flaunting of wealth, the vulgar show. Ought we to allow the church to be the stage on which such worldliness is paraded? I merely ask the question. Just as in the morality-conscious 19th century, a proper wedding conferred respectability, so now the conspicuous display of wealth at some weddings proclaims to all that the family or the couple have made it in a society dominated by materialistic values. And I simply ask, do we wish the church to be identified with such consumerism? There are couples who would never consider getting married in church because they want nothing to do with the trappings which accompany the big wedding or the bride's big day. Others who are less high-minded are simply deterred by the cost. And just as in the 18th century the cost of a legal marriage deterred couples from marriage, so now the cost of a proper wedding, with all its trimmings, can do just the same. Well, there are two minor problems which I'm sure often give us pause for thought, and you may have views on them afterwards in discussion. But the main problem I wish to bring to you is a problem which presents itself at vestry hour with increasing frequency, and which causes me, and I'm sure you, a great deal of heart-searching: the problem of couples who wish to be married in church who are already living together. The other day I read of an Anglican priest who serves in an inner-city parish in South London who said in the past 10 years he had only one wedding. In my parish, he said, people don't marry anymore. Now, I don't think things have got to quite that stage in Scotland, though I know from speaking to ministers in Glasgow Presbytery who work in places like Castlemilk, Easterhouse and Drumchapel that a great many of those who come to arrange a wedding have been cohabiting. But generally, cohabitation is a minority choice. As one sociologist puts it, a deviant phenomenon rather than a social institution. In Scotland, however, the law does take cognizance of long-term cohabitation, and couples who've lived together for a certain length of time may, through the Court of Session, be declared married by habit and repute. But more of that in a moment. Now, couples may live together for any number of reasons. Many do so, of course, for economic reasons. It's cheaper to live together than in separate accommodation. Others can't afford to get married, and so they live together instead. Still others, who have been married before, are prevented from marrying until their divorce comes through. Meantime, they live together. Some live together in order to find out if they can get on with one another before deciding whether or not to marry. And so cohabiting is an experiment in living together. There are a few who live together for ideological reasons. They reject marriage as an institution, and here one thinks of some feminists who will have nothing to do with marriage because they see it as a means of oppressing women. Then there are those who don't marry out of fear of making that commitment which marriage entails. Perhaps what they've seen of their parents' marriage has decided them against making that kind of commitment. Or perhaps the scars of a previous marriage has made them unwilling to risk failure a second time, because they feel that for them, marriage is jinxed. And then there are many who simply drift into cohabitation for no good reason. Their justification is simply that everybody does it. Well, what ought our response to couples who cohabit be? Before telling you how I respond, I think we need to be clear in our minds as to what marriage is. There's been a great deal of discussion over the past years as to what legitimately may terminate a marriage, and whether those whose marriages have ended in divorce may remarry in church. But far less attention has been given to when a marriage begins. And so the question, what makes a marriage? Now, some see marriage in terms of a legal ceremony, either in church before a minister or in a registry office before a registrar. The ceremony makes the marriage, and the marriage is identified with the ceremony. However, as we've already noted, in Scotland, no formal ceremony is required for a marriage to be valid. I'm told that that is also true in some states in the USA. If a couple have cohabited and are known as husband and wife by habit and repute, then they may approach the Court of Session in Scotland for a declaration that they are married. And the reason for this resort to the courts is often a desire to establish inheritance after the death of one of the parties, or to legitimize their children. Or it may be that a wedding would be an embarrassment to the couple and to their children in a close-knit community which has always thought of them as husband and wife. A similar position existed in England prior to Lord Hardwicke's Act of 1753, by which common law marriage became invalid. And the Marriage Act of 1949 doesn't recognize any contract of marriage or cohabitation made outside the provisions of the Act. But Scots law does, and thus recognizes that what makes a marriage is not just the legal ceremony. The report of the commission appointed by the Archbishops of Canterbury and York, entitled The Church and the Law of Nullity of Marriage, 1955, makes the same point. I quote, "From time to time it has been argued that some particular sign, for instance the holding of hands or the giving of a ring or rings, is of the essence of a form of marriage. The arguments have not found general acceptance in the church. It has also been argued that the benediction pronounced by the priest before whom the contract is made is of the essence of the form of marriage, or that the priest before whom the marriage takes place is the minister of the sacrament. This is not so. The generally accepted view of Western Christendom has been that the parties are themselves the ministers, and that no priestly benediction is necessary for the validity of the marriage." And Emil Brunner, in The Divine Imperative, writes in the same vein. He says, "Law and custom can never create a marriage. Again and again, the state may give the name of marriage to a union which in its inequality is not a real marriage. Nevertheless, this doesn't make the marriage any more real. And a true marriage cannot be annulled by the law of the state or by any social custom. Though what I have just said indicates that the consent of the state forms part of a complete marriage. Moreover, says Brunner, the blessing of the church upon a marriage may be, and indeed is, a sensible and significant custom. But in principle, marriage, and even Christian marriage, is independent of it." The view, then, that it is the ceremony that makes the marriage. Then there are others who've argued from 1 Corinthians 6:16, you know the words, "Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh." Others have argued from that scripture that marriage is effected through sexual intercourse. In other words, in God's eyes, a man and a woman are married rather a man or a woman, are married to that member of the opposite sex with whom they first had sexual relations. Now, it is the case that both the church and the state agree that unconsummated marriage is no real marriage and may be declared null and void. But does the mere fact that a couple have had intercourse make them man and wife? It's true that the Bible describes the act of coitus as a kind of knowing, Genesis 4:1, and teaches that through intercourse a man and a woman become one flesh. And the phrase surely speaks not just of their physical union, because the word flesh in the Hebrew has a wider connotation. It also speaks of the marriage of two hearts and of two minds, or put it how you will. And where such deep underlying rapport doesn't exist, as in the casual encounter, what Ernest Hemingway described as a hurricane you-know-what, or the one-night stand, where one partner slips away before the other wakes up and leaves a message drawn in lipstick on the dressing table mirror. In those situations, can marriage be said to have taken place? If intercourse is the essence of marriage, then many who marry today, perhaps most who marry today, are committing adultery. What Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 6:16 is that sexual union creates a moral bond, and in the particular case he cites, an immoral bond, which he says no Christian should enter. But I don't think he's arguing that the bond so created is a permanent one. What then makes marriage, if it's not the wedding ceremony itself, whether religious or civil, or the act of intercourse? Well, surely the essence of marriage lies in the consent of both parties. This has been the traditional teaching of the church down the ages. Consummation does not of itself make the marriage. Rather, it's the proper consequence of that consent, without which there can be no true marriage. It's the private ratification, if you like, of a commitment publicly made. But it's the commitment which a man and a woman, in front of witnesses, to remain faithful to one another, it is that commitment which they make, both as sexual partners and in mutual support until death do them part, it's that commitment which makes a marriage. Now, certainly, the commitment is usually made in the context of a ceremony, either in the church or the registry office at which vows are taken in the presence of witnesses. And so, in the eyes of the law, marriage is a contract. And that being so, care is taken that the parties enter the contract without duress, and that there are no hidden impediments to the terms of the contract being fulfilled. And that's why witnesses and the couples themselves are charged in the most solemn terms to confess any known impediment. That's how the law sees marriage. It's a contract. As Christians, we might prefer to speak of a covenant. And not just a covenant between a man and a woman, but a covenant they enter into before God. You know the words of Proverbs 2:17 speaks of the woman who has left the partner of her youth and ignored the covenant she made before God, or literally, the covenant of God. But whether legal contract or covenant entered into before God, it is the consent of the couple which makes the marriage. The context in which such consent occurs is briefly but fully spelt out in Genesis 2:24. The marriage union is seen first as exclusive. You know the text, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The marriage union is first of all exclusive. It speaks of a man and his wife. Secondly, it's publicly recognized. He leaves his parents. Thirdly, it is permanent. He cleaves to his wife. And fourthly, it is consummated by sexual intercourse. They become one flesh. Well, we've asked the question, what makes a marriage? And when does marriage begin? The next question is, how does cohabitation fit into this scheme of things? Well, the short answer may be that it doesn't fit at all. Or it could be that there is some tie-up which provides pointers as to how the problem should be handled pastorally. Put baldly, the question is, are there circumstances in which a couple who cohabit ought to be regarded as married from a moral and a social point of view? To help answer that question, let's look for a moment at what have traditionally been described as the goods of Christian marriage. There are three, and it was Augustine who first spelt them out, and they're referred to in most marriage services. They are, first, the remedy against sin. That's Cranmer's phrase in the Book of Common Prayer. Our Book of Common Order puts the matter less robustly when it says that marriage was given to us by God for the expression of the natural instincts and affections which God has implanted in us. That's the first good. The second one is the upbringing of children. And the third is mutual help and comfort. These are the three goods which stem from the commitment which a man and a woman make to one another in marriage. The question I pose is this, and here perhaps I'm being the devil's advocate. If a relationship exhibits the goods and the qualities of that commitment which is held to be at the core of Christian marriage, is the relationship immoral per se? A cohabiting couple will almost certainly not have expressed their consent formally, though a lawyer friend tells me that a few do write out a form of contract with one another. But their relationship may be based on mutual consent and may offer as much or as little help and comfort as a conventional marriage. When life becomes difficult and they're tempted to give up the relationship, they may lack the encouragement to persevere which the formal consent given before a minister or a registrar may provide. Though given the high incidence of marriage breakup, the moral support given by the institution of marriage would appear to be minimal. They may also lack the protection which the words, "Let not man put asunder," provides against prowling Romeos, or for that matter, disapproving parents or in-laws. And though in practice family life may not differ all that much from that in a proper marriage, the legal position of the father is certainly tenuous. As to sexual fidelity, a couple who live together may be as true to one another as a married couple. The intention of the couple to remain together till death do them part is harder to assess, but the same, alas, is now true of marriage as well. A poll taken some years ago of married couples revealed that 75% didn't regard the marriage vows as binding. So you see, in many respects, the relationship between a couple who live together may exhibit the goods of marriage. To all intents and purposes, they are married. The question is whether their relationship is immoral. But if the relationship amounts to a marriage, then is it necessarily wrong? I only pose the question. On that score, may I read to you from One Flesh by Paul Ramsey. Ramsey has a knack of putting simple things in a difficult way. I'll just read you a paragraph or two. He says, "The older Christian tradition never had any difficulty in extending to what are nowadays called premarital relations, what is nowadays called a compassionate judgment. In fact, it gave no one but the parties themselves the competence to render any judgment at all upon such pre-ceremonial sexual relations between engaged couples. Neither the state nor the church had anyone the right to say they did wrong. The very opposite was the case. The presumption was that they did the right thing. The presumption was that their betrothal consent to be married in the future was changed in the internal forum of their consciences into a present consent to marry before they engaged in sexual relations. The presumption was that they were fully responsibly married without the ceremony and before their acts of sexual love, which were then an expression and nurturing of the bond between them. This bond, their marriage, was present by their own making pre-ceremonially. and of course by the very nature of marriage, responsibility, marriage had to be present, if it was present, before copulation, since no acts, or no number of acts of copulation are able to make a marriage. The parties alone make marriage, and only they can say whether this was their meaning and their intention toward one another. I don't know if you follow all that, but what he's saying is that in the case of engaged couples who had premarital relations, what he is arguing is that Christian tradition in the past assumed that they had agreed between themselves that they were married in the internal forum of their consciences. Therefore, the sexual relations were in that context. There is, however, one respect in which cohabitation and marriage differ quite fundamentally. Cohabitation is a private arrangement with no legal standing, though I see that in Hollywood, couples who've lived together now sue one another for desertion. Whereas, of course, marriage is a public declaration which has the backing of the law. Now, some may cohabit because they want to keep the law out of their private world. But that, of course, is a miscalculation. Though the Family Law Reform Act of 1987 has gone a long way to minimize the significance of illegitimacy, I think I'm right in saying that a cohabiting father has still to go to the courts before he can exercise parental rights, as in, for instance, the death of the mother. And the drawing up of a will would also require the expert help of a lawyer. And so cohabiting couples can't avoid the law from entering into their relationship. The fact of the matter is that marriage is not just a private understanding between two people, as Ramsay seems to make out. It belongs to the public realm. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, that is an observable event, and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And those who are impatient with the legalities of a registry office wedding or the ceremony of a church wedding fail to see that their relationship is not just their business and no one else's, but that it's of wider significance. Again, if I may quote Brunner, the purely individualistic view of marriage involves a complete misunderstanding of the public and legal aspect of marriage. The civil official becomes a ridiculous figure. The interference of the state is regarded as a degradation of a union founded on love. As a reaction against an excessive emphasis upon the legal and social aspect of the question, which formed part of the older tradition, this is quite intelligible. Actually, however, the severance of marriage from the system of law and custom is wholly wrong. Marriage, sex relations in general, is a matter which concerns not merely the two interested parties themselves, but the community as a whole. For it is the source of the nation's power, to watch over which is the duty of the guardians of the common weal. This is self-evident, not only of the marriage which has already become fruitful, but also of the potentially fruitful marriage. The nation must see to it that the well should not be poisoned, but also that it should not be stopped up. And so the couple can't pretend that their relationship is only of concern to themselves. It's of concern to society at large, and also to their families in particular. And hence the importance of the wedding reception, tense and stressful occasions, though they often are. From a Christian point of view, cohabiting couples, in consummating their relationship before marrying, also miss the dimension which waiting until the appropriate time adds to their union. Scripture calls for continence prior to the marriage ceremony, whatever form it may take. And this is illustrated, isn't it, in the behavior of Joseph, who, though he was more in the position of a husband to Mary than a fiancé, he was betrothed to her in the Jewish sense of that word. Joseph knew that it was entirely inappropriate for him to act as a husband towards Mary until the appropriate time for consummation had arrived. And so cohabitation misses out on what John White in his book Eros Defile describes as the wonder of an awaited consummation. Well, perhaps the time has come to share with you how I respond to cohabiting couples who ask to be married in church. Very quickly, and I shall be interested to hear what you do. If a couple who are living together ask me to marry them because they want to regularize their relationship, then I'm happy to help them do so, the understanding being that the wedding will take place as soon as is decently possible. The difficulty I find is that many couples are talking of a wedding in 9 months or a year's time. In other words, they approach their marriage as do other couples, and in the meantime, they will continue to live together. To them, I say, I'm happy to marry you on two conditions. Either you marry as soon as possible, or if that isn't possible, you stop living together until you get married. You see, what is at stake is the integrity of Christian marriage, the integrity of the church, and the integrity of the couple. Imagine the marriage in church of a couple who've been living together for the past year or two. The gathered guests know that the couple have been living together, and they also know that the wedding has been arranged for some time. The service is the standard service. There's nothing in the service to indicate that the couple's lifestyle up until the wedding day has been out of step with those ideals which Christian marriage enshrines. And so as they sit in the pew, they ask themselves, does the church have no view on cohabitation? Does it matter if a couple come together before they marry, or whether they remain apart? Is it a matter of indifference to the church? It would seem to be so, they say. And so in a day of deep moral confusion, the church sends out confusing signals, and people are left wondering where the church stands. And so the integrity of Christian marriage and the integrity of the church is at stake. And the integrity of the couple, too, that's also at stake. If they wish to be married in church, then shouldn't they at the very least demonstrate their good faith by bringing their lifestyle into step with Christian standards, if they're talking of a wedding 9 months ahead or a year ahead? And so I feel it's reasonable to ask them to stop living together. Now, couples respond in different ways to the approach I've outlined. That's an understatement. I've had couples storm out of the vestry. I've had angry parents come to me and say, how dare I pass judgment on their children? And I would have to say that in my experience the response has been largely negative. But whether the response is negative or positive, there will be need for pastoral follow-up, perhaps particularly if the response has been negative. The follow-up of the couple, if they respond positively to your response, then they will need help to structure their lives anew, particularly if they've been living together and they're now going to stop living together until they get married. If they storm out of the vestry, then pastoral follow-up is again necessary, if they will allow it. Then the parents too, they require pastoral care. In most cases, they'll be upset by your refusal to marry their son or their daughter in the church. I found that had the couples been left to themselves, they probably would have gone to the registry office. Usually it's a mother in the background who wants a church wedding, because it would be embarrassing to explain to family and neighbors and friends why the wedding wasn't taking place in church. They don't want an office, a registry office wedding, and so they encourage the couple to come to the church. But had the couple been left to their own devices, I've no doubt that in many cases they would have made for the registry office. Just one last comment, a general comment, which perhaps underlines the differing approaches which may be taken to this problem and other moral issues which trouble us as ministers. In our approach to this and other moral issues, we may either hold up to society the Christian ideal, which of course stands in sharp distinction to the standards which obtain in society and often leave people feeling condemned and guilty, Or we may seek to affirm and deepen in a relationship that which corresponds to the Christian ideal, rather than condemning it for what it appears to lack. I'm not so sure that it is a case of either or. Probably a bit of both are required. But I've bared my soul to you, and I now await with interest to hear how you handle similar situations. Thank you.